Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times for the week of Sunday, September 18th. We'll begin with the few local articles that they've written this week, followed by state stories that have appeared in the Standard Times, some local sports, and then we'll wrap it up with Allison Watkins' column. Froyo and Sweets opens in downtown San Angelo, by Rosanna Frere, published September 22nd. A new frozen yogurt and candy shop is now open for business in downtown San Angelo. The owners of Old Central Firehouse Pizzeria and Tap Room, Michelle and Jody Babish, purchased the frozen yogurt equipment from TJ's Frozen Yogurt, which recently closed. The shop owners will be Babish's daughters, Sierra Brady and Dakota Heath. It's really the girls' business, and I'm just trying to help them out with the knowledge I have from owning a couple of businesses, Michelle said. Froyo and Sweets downtown is located at 17 West Beauregard Avenue, serving frozen yogurt and bulk candy served by the ounce. The shop also has murals painted by local artist Ashley Perales, owner of Pop of Color. The business opened Wednesday, September 21st. Its hours of operation are 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday and noon to 4 p.m. Sunday. We are beyond grateful for everyone who stopped by yesterday and enjoyed some froyo, hugged us, shared your pictures on social media, and all of the well wishes, a Facebook post from the business stated. This was a labor of love of our families, and it fills our heart to see the excitement y'all have for Froyo Sweets downtown. Circle S Corn Maze and Pumpkin Patch in Wall, set to open for 2022 fall season. By Rosanna Frere, published September 16th. The Circle S Acres Corn Maze and Pumpkin Patch in Wall will open for its 2022 fall season Friday, September 30th. This is the seventh year for the festive destination about 12 miles southeast of San Angelo at 7305 Bean Road in Wall. Its feature attraction is a maze that winds through 4 acres of corn. Circle S revealed its design for the 2022 season, which is Noah's Ark. Circle S will be closed Monday and Tuesday and open from 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday, and 1 to 6 Sunday. There is a $2 admission to the property. Costs for the corn maze are $8 for adults, $5 for children, and free for children 2 and younger. Barrel train is $4. Corn cannons are $1 a shot. Trebuchet is $10 to launch. The pumpkin patch has more than 30 varieties of pumpkins available that come from Floydada. Prices on the pumpkins range from $1 to $15. There is also a mural set up for a photo op created by San Angelo artist Kat Freeney. The pumpkin patch also offers flower picking on Saturday and Sunday only, while blooms last. Granary Grub is the concession stand available selling drinks, hamburgers, hot dogs, nachos, Frito pies, and drinks. Field trips are available during October from Monday through Friday at 9 or 11 a.m. Email customer service at circleacres.com with inquiries. This year, the Haunted Corn Maze is on October 21st and 22nd and 28th and 29th. Into the wild blue yonder for 75 years, Air Force celebrates milestone. By Greg Jakelowitz, Abilene Reporter News, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 18th. Sunday marks the 75th anniversary of the U.S. Air Force. The Air Force took flight September 18, 1947, as a separate branch of the military with the enactment of the National Security Act. The Air Force landed in Abilene less than 10 years later. The site for what would become Dyess Air Force Base initially was Abilene Army Air Base, opened December 18, 1942. After World War II, the city of Abilene sought an Air Force base, and a fundraising effort led to the 3-year construction of a permanent base near Tye. It opened in 1956, celebrating Abilene's Diamond Jubilee. In December of that year, it was named for Lieutenant Colonel William E. Dyess, a pilot and Bataan Death March survivor from Shackelford County. The first unit was the 341st Bombardment Wing. Today, Dyess is home to the 7th Bomb Wing and its fleet of B-1 bombers. Those are expected to be joined this decade by the B-2A Raider, with B-1 fully retired when the transition is completed. Dyess is also home to the 317th Airlift Wing, with its C-130Js serving global missions. One of the most memorable days for Dyess and Abilene came June 29, 1985, when the first B-1 flew over Abilene and landed at the base, with a crowd of about 45,000 there to witness history. It was the first new aircraft for the Air Force in 20 years. A B-1 named the Star of Abilene soon came and served for 17 years, 7 months, and 23 days, according to Air Force records. It was retired in March 2003 and can be seen in the Static Aircraft Museum that flanks the road leading from the main gate toward the central area of the base. State news. Texas Bureau. Greg Abbott says his border security message hits home in Hispanic South Texas. The Republican governor said Hispanic voters in South Texas are receptive to conservative messaging and understand the need for border security. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 21st. Alice. In a county that is 80% Hispanic and that he lost by 5 percentage points 4 years ago, Governor Greg Abbott, at a campaign stop Tuesday, said that his twin messages of border security and robust law enforcement are the key to Republicans' efforts to wrest South Texas from the grips of the Democrats. All you've got to do is look at what is the most important in the state, and that is the border, Abbott told the USA Today Network in his first sit-down interview with a traditional print media outlet of the fall campaign. And where is that most important? At the border. The governor, seeking his third four-year term against a well-known and well-funded Beto O'Rourke in the November 8th election, was the featured attraction of the Jim Wells County Republican Party gathering inside a packed community center in Alice. The venue is a two-hour drive from the Rio Grande and 45 minutes from the Gulf Coast. And most of the audience cheered loudly when he talked about his sometimes controversial policies that send thousands of state troopers and National Guard soldiers to virtually all corners of South Texas. We've seen already the way that South Texas is changing, and it's changing for several reasons, Abbott said during his 25-minute speech. One reason is because of the anger that so many people have because of Joe Biden's open border policies that will not be tolerated. Describing his four-month effort to send migrants who crossed into Texas without authorization and are now awaiting rulings on whether they can remain in the United States on buses to Washington, Chicago, and New York City, Abbott drew loud cheers. Before the buses began rolling, Abbott said, most people in the United States did not know what was going on the border. But my God, as soon as they started showing up in New York City, the entire country knew what was going on the U.S. border. At campaign stops of his own in Corpus Christi, in San Antonio, and along the border over the weekend, O'Rourke called the bus policy a stunt to get attention in conservative media outlets that does not address the economic and political drivers of illegal immigration. Instead of buses filled with immigrants, O'Rourke, at his rallies, spoke of wooden crates and truck tractors used to smuggle immigrants into the United States, including the deadly incident in June where the bodies of about 50 people were found inside an abandoned tractor trailer near Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. Abbott has laid the blame for the surge in illegal immigration at Biden's feet, saying the Democratic president should not have rolled back former President Donald Trump's hardline immigration policies. The message resonated with Christina Ariza, who lives in Jim Wells County and whose grandfather was a 37-year veteran of the Corpus Christi Police Department. It might sound wrong to say it, but we cannot have all of this illegal immigration, said Ariza, who was among the dozens of people who stood in line to pose for a photo with Abbott. I support what the governor is trying to do. So did Bill Wright, who described himself as a former Democrat who no longer supports what he calls the party's communist socialist agenda. Let's just say I'm a Republican now and leave it at that, Wright said. Ricardo Rick Rubio, a 21-year Air Force veteran who is running for treasurer of Jim Wells County, said he is campaigning to find more people like Wright to join those who are already Republicans in the county of about 40,000 people that in 2016 went to Democrat Hillary Clinton and 11 points and to Trump by 10 4 years later. We go back and forth, but I'm trying to knock on every door and talk to everybody who'll talk with me, Rubio said. I think we can flip it for good. In the interview, Abbott said such a view is becoming increasingly apparent in the socially conservative, but sometimes still Democrat-voting South Texas. Asked about South Texas, especially those of Hispanic origin who are conservative on social issues such as abortion rights, but still in need of government assistance such as an expanded Medicaid network, Abbott pivoted. Some of these people are first-generation Americans, he said. They didn't come to this country for some leftist progressive agenda. They came for the freedom that is unique to the United States of America. John C. Moritz covers Texas government and politics for the USA Today Network in Austin. $60 million in Permian Basin oil and gas assets bought up by Texas company. By Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus, published September 20th in the San Angelo Standard Times. About $60 million in oil and gas-producing assets were bought up by a Texas energy company on the western side of the Permian Basin, which crosses the border between New Mexico and Texas. U.S. Energy Development Corporation announced the deal September 13th that included 17 wells throughout the Permian's western Delaware sub-basin. Chief Executive Officer Jordan Jason said the assets were expected to produce about $100 million worth of oil and gas by the start of 2023. The company plans to acquire about $400 million more in oil and gas lands and facilities over the next 2 years in the Permian and other fossil fuel regions in the U.S. We are very pleased to acquire three new asset opportunities in the Permian Basin, Jason said. With this expanded well count, we anticipate approximately $100 million of new production to come online by the end of the calendar year. That deal came during a time of increased U.S. fuel demand and pressure on Permian Basin operators to produce more oil and gas. Domestic oil was trading at about $85 a barrel as of Monday, per the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, maintaining in the $80s and $90 range throughout August and early September. Although the latest price marked a gradual decline from a peak of about $122 a barrel reported June 8th, per Historica data from NASDAQ, it was well ahead of prices reported mostly in the $60 range before the COVID-19 pandemic, which led to a historic drop-off in the market that recovered throughout 2022. To help meet growing transportation needs of fossil fuel producers, the Permian Highway Pipeline was planned to be expanded to a capacity of up to 550 million cubic feet of natural gas per day, moving it from the basin across Texas to the Gulf Coast in the southeast region of the state where gas is processed and exported. The expansion project was expected to be complete by the end of 2023. And a company from Louisville, Kentucky, signed on to manufacture and supply high-pressure closure valves along the Permian Highway, per a news release. General Manager of Cypress Technologies, Brett Keener, said the work will help the pipeline send more fossil fuels to market and increase the energy provided by the U.S. and Permian Basin to the global market. By leveraging our extensive engineering design and manufacturing expertise, we believe we are uniquely qualified to support these types of demanding requirements, he said. We are proud to be part of a project with a goal to help provide reliable energy and improve lives around the world. And as more oil and gas is produced in the basin, more facilities could be needed for companies to manage water, both needed in hydraulic fracturing and produced during the extraction process. To capitalize on this need and growth in the water midstream sector, two such companies announced a merger intended to increase the scale of water services offered to oil and gas companies in the Delaware Basin. Pilot Water Solutions and Oilfield Water Logistics announced their merger September 16th, focused on the region spanning southeast New Mexico and West Texas. The combined company held 129 saltwater disposal wells where oilfield wastewater is pumped back underground, along with 850 miles of pipelines with a disposal capacity of 2.5 million barrels of water per day. It will also have 34 source, recycling, and evaporation facilities. Produced water, brought to the surface with oil and gas, is often re-injected underground for disposal or recycled and reused in subsequent operations to curb injection's impact on inducing earthquakes, which recently became a growing concern in the Permian Basin. While the company is focused on the Delaware Basin region, it also had operations in other oil and gas regions like the Eagle Ford Basin in South Texas and the Marcellus Natural Gas Shale in Pennsylvania. Bringing together our complementary systems will extend our best-in-class service to producers across the northern Delaware Basin and offer increased reach, reliability, and capacity in seismically quiet areas of the basin, said Pilot CEO Anuj Sharma. Additionally, our expansive combined footprint will enable us to reliably meet our customers' growing recycling needs in New Mexico. Oilfield Water Logistics CEO Todd Abbott said more production in the region meant larger amounts of water to be managed. Through the combined strength of our new platform, we are well positioned to meet the challenges of rising water volumes and to provide enhanced value for our customers, Abbott said. Texas Sheriff launches inquiry into migrant flights to Martha's Vineyard backed by Florida Governor DeSantis, by Sergio Bustos, USA Today Network, Florida, published in the San Angelo Standard-Times, September 20th. Tallahassee, Florida. Texas law enforcement authorities said Monday that they are opening an investigation into how 48 Venezuelan migrants were lured last week to board flights from San Antonio, Texas, to Martha's Vineyard under a plan orchestrated by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for nothing more than a photo op. Our understanding is that a Venezuelan migrant was paid what we would call a bird dog fee to recruit approximately 50 migrants from the area around a migrant resource center in San Antonio, Bexar County, Texas, Sheriff Javier Salazar told reporters. As we understand it, 48 migrants were lured, I will use the word lured, under false pretenses, into staying at a hotel for a couple of days, said Salazar, who said the migrants were then taken by plane at a certain point and flown to Florida before continuing to Massachusetts. Salazar, an elected Democrat from South Texas, said the migrants were taken out of Texas to Martha's Vineyard under false pretenses, and they were promised work and promised the solution to several of their problems. They were taken to Martha's Vineyard from what we can gather for nothing more for a little more than a photo op, video op, and then they were unceremoniously stranded in Martha's Vineyard, Salazar said. Florida's Republican governor has told reporters that he plans to continue paying to transport migrants detained at the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas to keep them from settling in Florida and sending them to sanctuary cities around the country. He also said he wants to call attention to the Biden administration's reckless border security policies. Last Wednesday, without informing local officials in Texas or Massachusetts, DeSantis ordered the state to shuttle the migrants aboard two chartered planes from San Antonio to Martha's Vineyard. I got $12 million to use, so we are going to use it, he said, because I think people want to see that we're actually standing up and trying to protect the state against President Biden's really, really reckless policies. The $12 million refers to money the Florida legislature approved this year to pay for relocating undocumented immigrants in Florida. We want to make sure that Florida taxpayers are not having tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people coming in illegally, he said. DeSantis says plan took shape in 2021. The White House has criticized DeSantis and Texas Governor Greg Abbott, both Republicans, for their political stunt and for using migrants as political pawns. It said that its new aggressive campaign against human smugglers had netted thousands of arrests in recent months and that Border Patrol agents removed or expelled more people than any year before. DeSantis said his plan took shape last year when he visited the U.S.-Mexico border to help Abbott deal with illegal border crossings. DeSantis said he and his staff learned that 40% of migrants apprehended at the border expressed a desire to move to Florida. The governor said it was more effective to intercept migrants at the border than it was to track them down when they arrived in Florida as individuals or in small groups. If they get in a car with two other people, there's no way we're going to be able to detect that, DeSantis said. So, DeSantis said, they hired a contractor to identify migrants likely headed to Florida and offer free transportation to sanctuary jurisdictions. And so they went from Texas to Florida to Martha's Vineyard in the flight, DeSantis said. I simply feel misled. Several Venezuelans who landed in Martha's Vineyard told their immigration attorneys and journalists that they had been promised jobs and housing if they boarded the flights. They were not told they were going to New England. One Venezuelan, Pedro Luis Torralba, 36, said he was promised work, food, and housing and thought he was going to New York. I am not a victim, he said. I simply feel misled because they told a lie and it has come to nothing. Domingo Garcia, president of the League of United Latin American Citizens, a Washington-based civil rights group, said the migrants were given red folders with fake documents promising jobs and housing. It was all just a terrible lie, Garcia said, adding that he plans to file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice. DeSantis said none were misled or misguided when approached by the contractor in Texas who was hired to profile these migrants, most likely to want to travel to Florida. He rejected claims of critics that the Venezuelan migrants were kept in the dark about their final destination. The contractor gave migrants a release form to sign, along with a packet that included a map of Martha's Vineyard, said DeSantis, who said it was all voluntary. It's obvious that's where they were going, he said, adding that the migrants were treated well with meals and everything for their trip to Martha's Vineyard. Our view is you've got to deal with it at the source. And if they're intending to come to Florida, and many of them are intending to come to Florida, this is our best way to make sure that they end up in a sanctuary jurisdiction. DeSantis said Florida now has the infrastructure in place to steer future migrants from Florida to sanctuary cities. There needs to be accountability, he said. Texas leads nation in books banned from schools, Free Speech Group's analysis finds. By Claire Lawrence, Austin American Statesman, published in the San Angelo Standard-Times, September 19th. Texas has banned 801 books spanning 22 school districts in the past year, more than any other state, according to an analysis released by PEN America, a 100-year-old organization focused on the protection of literacy, expression, and human rights. Among the group's key findings, from July 2021 to June 2022, PEN America's index of school book ban lists 2,532 instances of individual books being banned, affecting 1,648 unique book titles by 1,261 different authors. Bans occurred in 138 school districts in 32 states. The districts represent nearly 4 million students. Among the 1,648 book titles, 674, 41%, explicitly address LGBTQ+ themes or have protagonists or prominent secondary characters who are LGBTQ+, and 659 titles, 40%, contain protagonists or prominent secondary characters of color. Texas has 801 banned titles in 22 districts. PEN America defines a school book ban as any action taken against a book based on its content and as a result of parent or community challenges, administrative decisions, or in response to direct or threatened action by lawmakers or other governmental officials that leads to a previously accessible book being either completely removed from availability to students or where access to a book is restricted or diminished. PEN America's database as of Monday shows that the Leander School District, which straddles Williamson and Travis counties, has a total of 11 titles banned, some of which include Brave Face, a memoir by Sean David Hutchinson, a book about 19-year-old Hutchinson growing up gay and suffering with depression, and In the Dream House, a memoir by Carmen Maria Machado that follows her years in an abusive same-sex marriage. Last year, the district undertook a community review process that led to the removal of the 11 books from book club lists in classrooms. Some of the books that were initially paused were reinstated. Review committees were made up of district staffers, community members, and students. The only other Austin area school district in the database, the Lake Travis District in western Travis County, has one banned book, Out of Darkness by Ashley Hope Perez. The district said it received complaints about explicit descriptions of sex in the historical novel, which follows an interracial teenage love affair in East Texas in the 1930s. Penn's report shows trends of banned books with LGBTQ+ themes, main characters who are people of color, sexual content, and issues of racism. There's a lot of different groups, I think, who are being targeted beyond race, director of Penn America, William Johnson, said. If you block access to opinions and knowledge, you block access to education. That's why organizations like Penn are important, especially right now, when you see all kinds of censors and threats popping up all over the country. The organization is collaborating with the Austin Public Library Foundation to hold a free community reading from 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday at the Spider House Ballroom, 2908 Fruit Street in Central Austin, to recognize literary rights during Banned Books Week 2022. The event will feature local leaders and reading banned material aloud. Tim Staley, the executive director of the foundation and the president of Austin's chapter of Penn, said the best way for people to encounter enhanced reading experiences is by being able to read what they want. The goal is to heighten the public's awareness of the issue of book censorship, which is to say there are people out there who are telling students and others what they should and should not read, Staley said. Book censorship is happening, and people should be aware of it, because if people are aware, we may be more likely to resist these efforts of censorship. Students have begun to combat bans in their own ways. The American Statesman recently reported on a group of students at Vandergriff High School who created a banned book club last school year amid the growing reality of censorship in district libraries. Literary culture cannot thrive if people can't read freely, express their opinions, or share ideas, Penn America's Johnson said. On one hand, we celebrate literature, but we also try to create an environment where literature can thrive. If it can't thrive, freedom of expression doesn't exist. Outside of school libraries and classrooms, book bans have started to become prominent in public libraries too, according to Staley. It is particularly alarming, he said. There's always been a school board here or there that has identified certain titles they feel a kid shouldn't have access to, but this is proliferating much beyond an isolated incident here and there. This is becoming what seems to be a broader effort to restrict people's freedom to read. According to Penn's report, pressure from politicians and other organizations, such as County Citizens Defending Freedom, are felt by districts in Texas and directly affect the books leaving shelves. State Representative Matt Krause, Republican Fort Worth, and Governor Greg Abbott asked districts earlier this year to examine books that might contain pornographic content, and Krause sent a list of 850 books to districts in a letter. According to the report, Abbott has not given any specific examples of what might be considered pornographic. The Texas Education Agency modeled a new policy that several districts are now following, though the policy changes mentioned in the model are not required for all districts. According to the report, the TEA's policy calls for librarians to host biannual reviews for parents to voice objections and concerns and define harmful material based on the Texas Penal Code. In other cases, Houston area school districts such as Katy, Cypress Fairbanks, and Clear Creek took action toward book bans based on what neighboring districts were doing, according to the report. Penn encourages authors whose titles are being banned to reach out to the organization or become involved in a plan to address the issues. For Johnson, Penn's biggest focus is providing information for communities to better understand these efforts. We have extensive reporting around these threats that are happening, so the community is made aware, Johnson said. By providing that information, they can make decisions on how they want to move forward. But first, people need to know these threats exist in their communities. U.S. immigration officials say they dismantled multi-million-dollar human smuggling ring. A newly unsealed indictment details accounts of migrants being sealed into crates and truck trailers as part of a lucrative operation to bring them across the border. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 16th. Austin. A lucrative and long-running human smuggling operation that brought hundreds of undocumented immigrants into the United States, often crammed into semi-truck trailers or sealed inside wooden crates, was disrupted and dismantled by Federal Immigration Task Force, a newly unsealed indictment from South Texas shows. The indictment, handed up by the federal court in Laredo on August 9th, details a multi-year and multi-million dollar operation involving at least 8 defendants and describes migrants being brought into the country after being hidden inside several sorts of vehicles or containers disguised as ordinary cargo with little regard for their safety or comfort. The methods smuggling operators used to transport migrants were particularly dangerous, the U.S. Attorney General for Office for the Southern District of Texas said in the indictment that was unsealed Tuesday. The operation's drivers transported migrants in suitcases placed inside pickup trucks, in the back of tractor trailers, under locked hard bed covers of pickup trucks, in empty water tanker trucks, and in empty wooden crate boxes that were strapped to flatbed trailers. The indictment also contains several photographs of migrants inside trailers and containers that were taken after being rescued by immigration officials. In a news release issued by the U.S. Justice Department and the Department of Homeland Security, officials said the smuggling operation was taken down by a unit called Joint Task Force Alpha that worked with the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico, and with unnamed law enforcement agencies within the United States. The details of the human smuggling operation in South Texas. The news release and indictment name Aramenia Serrano Piedra, 31, of Elgin, who the document says go by the nickname of Boss Lady, as the leader of the smuggling operation. The charges against Piedra and the others include conspiracy to transport aliens, putting people's lives in danger, and conspiracy to conceal, harbor, or shield from detection an alien for the purpose of commercial advantage or private financial gain. Authorities said all of the defendants have been apprehended and the arrests took place at unspecified locations in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. The indictment asks that the defendants be kept in custody until trial. In addition to prison time, if the defendants are convicted, the government is seeking the forfeiture of more than $2 million worth of property. This organization was motivated by personal greed, and Piedra and her co-conspirators prioritized that greed over the safety of those that they illegally smuggled, Assistant Attorney General Kenneth A. Polite Jr. said in remarks prepared for a news conference in Washington. Authorities said they traced Piedra's bank records and found that she had deposited more than $1.3 million in December 2017 and August 2021. They also said she had been detained by authorities in 2013 and 2017, but had not been prosecuted. The newly unsealed indictment says agents conducting surveillance in May 2021 heard loud thumps from a vehicle. They approached the covered bed portion of the truck and asked if there was anybody hiding under the cover, the indictment said. A female voice answered and stated she and others were trapped inside and were struggling to breathe. That discovery led authorities to 65 other migrants who were being kept at a stash house in Laredo. Human smuggling is a multi-billion dollar enterprise. According to a report published this year by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, people who are smuggled in the country are at risk of rape, beatings, kidnapping, and robbery. Transactional human smuggling is a multi-billion dollar enterprise and a daily occurrence along the southern border, according to the report. The Rio Grande Valley is the busiest area for human smuggling activity in the U.S. right now, the report says. From San Diego, California, to Brownsville, Texas, there is activity every day. In the operation targeted by Joint Task Force Alpha, which focuses on networks operating in Mexico and the Northern Triangle, the migrants typically paid their smugglers $8,000, $3,000 up front, and $5,000 upon arrival. Drivers were paid as much as $2,500 for each person they transported, according to court documents. The migrants were commonly referred to as boxes or packages by the smugglers. Why immigration is a political flashpoint. Illegal immigration and human smuggling have been a political flashpoint since unauthorized border crossings began to spike after Donald Trump left the White House and the Biden administration rolled back many of the former president's hardline policies. Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott has repeatedly said President Joe Biden, a Democrat, has done little or nothing to stem the flow of migrants and accused him of carrying out open border policies. In recent months, Abbott has sent migrants who have been given at least temporary permission to remain in the United States on buses to Washington, New York, and Chicago. Other Republican governors, including Florida's Ron DeSantis, have also transported migrants to other regions where Democrats are in charge. Without delving into the political debate, the Joint Task Force Alpha news release said the task force and other border-related moves by the Biden administration are unprecedented in scale to disrupt and dismantle these human smuggling networks. So far, Homeland Security has committed over $50 million and surged over 1,300 personnel in Latin America and along the southwest border, the release stated. The task force operations have so far resulted in 100 domestic and international arrests. And taken together, the administration's efforts have led to almost 5,000 arrests, according to the news release. Texas sees nearly 1 million new registered voters so far this year, with 3 weeks to go. Nearly 80% of the state's voting age population is registered to vote, representing a significant jump over the past decade. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 20th. Almost 1 million Texans registered to vote so far this year, with 3 weeks to go before the October 11th deadline for the November election, putting the number of people eligible to cast ballots to more than 17.5 million and counting. The raw new registration numbers are significantly higher than they were during the midterm election cycles of 2014 and 2018. But the percentage of people of voting age who are registered has increased only marginally over the past few years, according to records maintained by the Texas Security of State's Secretary of State's office. Put simply, the addition of new voters is largely offset by the number of people who have left the voter registration rolls, usually because they have died or left the state. In a recent series of tweets heading into Tuesday's National Voter Registration Day, the head of a national Democratic-aligned number-crunching firm said younger and more progressive Texans are fueling this year's uptick as a backlash against the Supreme Court's decision in June to overturn Roe v. Wade landmark ruling. "It's not just the younger voters who are surging in Texas since Dobbs," tweeted Tom Boyner, CEO of the firm. Target Smart, in a reference to the High Court's Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling on June 24th. "It's clear that those younger voters who are registering now, men and women, are far more Democratic." Derek Ryan, a Texas Republican researcher and consultant, expressed skepticism about the conclusion. Using Texas Secretary of State's office data over the three most recent midterm cycles, including this year, Ryan said the demographic characteristics of new registrants are remarkably consistent. For instance, in 2014, when Texas Republicans swept every statewide election in a landslide and won 97 of the 150 Texas House districts, 56% of the newly registered voters were women and 43% were 29 or younger. 4 years later, when Democrats gained 12 House seats and came tantalizingly close in at least three statewide elections, the demographic data was nearly identical. And with the 2022 voter registration deadline coming on October 11th, the demographic data so far this year is also nearly identical. The raw numbers of new voters are up, but the makeup within those numbers is pretty much consistent between this cycle and 2014 and 2018. Ryan said. Democrats trying to eke out a win in a statewide election for the first time since 1994 are counting on bringing in newly engaged voters, motivated by the loss of abortion rights as a result of the Dobbs ruling and the inaction of Texas Republican leaders on gun safety issues in the wake of the May 24th massacre at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde and other high-profile mass shootings in recent years. Several recent polls show several statewide races within single digits, including the marquee matchup between two-term Republican Governor Greg Abbott and Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke. But the polls also show the Democrats having a tough time winning over independent voters. That would suggest that any path to success in the fall lies with either new or perhaps infrequent voters. A more telling and perhaps more dramatic change in voter habits over the past decade plus has been turnout, which historically in Texas has been abysmally low. In the 2010 midterm election, only 38% of registered voters turned out, according to the Secretary of State's office. Presidential elections typically generate more interest, and in 2012, turnout reached 58%. But turnout bumped to 53% in the 2018 midterms, the highest for a midterm since 1990, and to 66.7% in the 2020 presidential election. That was the highest for any election in the state since 1992, when turnout was just a shade under 73%. And now we turn to local sports. Central QB Hill powers Bobcats to win over Belton, by Charles Bryce, published September 17th. Senior quarterback Tyler Hill ran for touchdowns of 20, 58, and 70 yards, and threw for another, sparking the San Angelo Central High School football team to a convincing 35-12 non-district blowout against Belton Friday night at San Angelo Stadium. Both teams are now 2-2. This was the first meeting between the Bobcats and Tigers in football. Central was coming off an overtime loss last week on the road against Abilene Cooper. The Bobcats have one non-district game left next week at home against Abilene Wiley. Senior wide receiver Jacob English got hurt late in last week's game against Cooper, and he wasn't able to suit up and play on his birthday Friday, but his teammates sang happy birthday to him while celebrating the win against the Tigers. It was a concerted effort all night by the Bobcats. "I was proud of all three phases, offense, defense, and special teams," Central head coach Kevin Crane said. "Everybody contributed. The offense had some explosive plays that really helped. Tyler busted a few off the end. And then JV and Robinson, too, had an explosive play." The defense certainly got better this week. That was a good offense. They had a big, tall quarterback. He was really a good player for them. I thought our defense played much improved. They took a step forward tonight, and I was glad to see that. Luke Gould and Jacoby Yates both had an interception for Central. The Bobcats jumped out to a 14-0 advantage early in the second quarter on a 35-yard TD run by Robinson. Central pushed its lead to 21-0 on its next possession on Hill's 58-yard TD scamper. After Belton cut the deficit to 21-6 on a 67-yard TD pass from quarterback Ty Brown to wide receiver Mason Ram, the Bobcats responded three plays later on Hill's 70-yard TD, making it 28-6 with 3:50 left in the second quarter. Belton got within 28-12 on a 2-yard TD run by Sean Snapp with 12 seconds left in the second, and that was the score at the half. Central finished off the scoring with a 5-yard TD strike from Hill to wide receiver Kevin Rice, making it 35-12 with 8:25 left in the fourth. "This game was something special to us," Hill said. "Before this game, we stood 1-2. We're 10 points from being 3-0. So going into this game, we knew we wanted it, and we knew we were a good team. We were barely losing to good teams, Cooper and Colleen Shoemaker. So going into this game, we wanted it bad. I think that was the biggest thing for us as a team, is going in here and staying hungry for it and staying hungry throughout the whole game." Hill's three TD runs were for a total of 148 yards. He finished with a team-high 155 yards rushing and was 18 of 26 passing for 167 yards and a TD. "Man, I almost felt bad because I wasn't giving my running back the ball, but it was too good to not pull it, so I had to pull the ball, the Bobcats QB said. I saw the holes. They were just too good a looks. I was tired, and they were long runs, but I got them. The central signal caller says his offensive line was a big reason why we won tonight. Despite being in street clothes, English had a big smile on his face on the sidelines, and he was cheering on his teammates all night. He's going to be fine, the central coach said of his senior wideout. He got hurt toward the end of the game against Cooper, and I didn't allow him to play this week. It was a good birthday present for him tonight. We had some younger guys step up tonight and do some good things. Keevan Rice got him a touchdown, which was good to see. I'm hoping that sparks his confidence a little bit. Ben Eimler got a big catch coming back this way in the second half, and that was good to see. We were able to spread the ball around again, which was good. Almost all of our receivers got touches and were able to catch the ball. We had some guys catch the ball out of the backfield as well. Next Friday's game against Abilene Wiley is homecoming for the Bobcats. The King and Queen will be crowned on Thursday. Crane says it'll be a tough test against Wiley. I got a sneak peek of them on film today, the Bobcat said. They look really good, so it's going to be a big game for us and a big challenge. Hopefully, we can go evaluate this film and celebrate this for 24 hours and get better from here on out. San Angelo Lakeview football grinds out road win over Lubbock High. By Stephen Garcia, Lubbock Avalanche Journal, published in the San Angelo Standard-Times, September 16th. High school football, non-district, San Angelo Lakeview 35, Lubbock High 21. After Lubbock High tied the game on its first drive of the second half, the Chiefs responded with a quick march for the go-ahead score. On runs of 11, 14, 17, 4, and 20, the last a touchdown by Ricky Ramirez, Lakeview regained the lead less than 2 minutes later. The Chiefs forced turnovers on two of the Westerners' next three possessions, and a 7-minute, 56-second drive sealed the win with Noah Rios' 5-yard TD plunge. What this game means. Lakeview is now 3-1, matching its win total from a season ago. The Chiefs now lead the all-time series 6-5. Lubbock High, 2-2, missed an opportunity to win its third game, which would be the most in a season since 2012. Thursday's highlights. Trini Tiarina made a nice grab to open the scoring. The Westerners receiver got his right hand on a sharp pass from Ivan McGuire and brought in a juggling catch for a 22-yard TD. Lakeview's David Torres stepped in front of a McGuire pass for an interception early in the fourth quarter. Thursday's stars. Ian Cortez paced the Chiefs' offense with 127 yards on 23 carries. He ran for two TDs, which tied the game, and gave Lakeview its first lead on consecutive drives late in the second quarter. Keith Ramirez again carried the load for the Westerners, finishing with 21 rushes for 94 yards and a TD. Lakeview coach Hector Guevara on the team overcoming a turnover and early 7-0 deficit. They just settled down, took a deep breath, stepped back a little bit, and recalibrated their minds. They understood they just had to execute within the scheme. Guevara on stopping Lubbock High on its last five possessions. They stepped up and they played together and grinded it out. We didn't give a big play in the fourth quarter, but we did early on in the second half. Our kids just kind of rallied behind everybody and just kept looking forward. Lubbock High coach Juan Rodriguez. We made a lot of mistakes. You can't beat a good ball club when you make mistakes like we did tonight. We shot ourselves in the foot a couple of times that we could have scored. Penalties killed us tonight. We didn't execute on offense. We didn't tackle well on defense. And those are things that we can still improve on and we can work on as a staff and a group of kids. Rodriguez on defending Lakeview. Their O-line was good. We knew that coming in tonight. They executed. They fire off the ball really well, and they handled us on the ground. They handled us in the trenches, and they won that battle tonight. Up next, Lakeview will face Leveland in another road game, Lebakai will travel to face Andrews. Number 5 Angelo State football team opens LSC play on the road against UTPB by Charles Bryce, published September 15th. The number 5 ranked Angelo State University football team will be taking some momentum into the Lone Star Conference opener on the road against UT Permian Basin on Saturday after a big non-conference win last week. The Rams improved to 2-0 after rallying to beat then number 12 Colorado School of Mines 30-27 in overtime in Golden, Colorado. ASU beat an ore digger squad that was 8-0 at home last year, and the Rams avenged a loss to Mines last year in the NCAA Division II quarterfinals. "It was a great win," ASU head coach Jeff Gersh said. "I was so proud of the kids, and that stayed true watching the film. But we left a lot of things out on the field that day against Mines. There's a lot to improve on, but the goal going into conference is always being 2-0 and undefeated moving forward, and we did that against two really good teams. So that part of it's character building, I think, and it kind of shows you that you've got that going into a challenging conference schedule starting with UTPB. UTPB, 1-1, is coming off a 34-31 double overtime decision against Western Colorado, which made the playoffs last year. "They're going to present their own problems to us," the Rams coach said of the Falcons. "We're going to have our hands full, but we're excited about moving forward." Kickoff is scheduled for 6 p.m. Saturday at Midland's Grande Communications Stadium. Radio coverage will be on KWFR 101.9 FM. Gersh talked about what concerns him most facing the Falcons. "Just their athleticism," the ASU coach said. "They've got some great players who can make plays with the ball in their hands. They've got a new transfer quarterback, sophomore Dylan Graham, and he's done some decent things for them. And they've got some receivers who can really play, man. That's probably the biggest thing, just controlling their athletes and keeping them under wraps a little bit and limiting explosive plays, and doing our best with what we do on defense and getting after the quarterback and making him make some bad reads and poor decisions with the football. That's our goal." ASU is 5-0 all-time against UTPB, including a 34-14 win at home last year. Rams junior running back Alfred Greer ran for 81 yards on 5 carries last week, including a 60-yard touchdown scamper. He was sidelined for all of the second half with an injury. "He'll be out this week," Gersh said of Greer. "They're just evaluating things and kind of seeing where it goes." The Rams will have next man up mentality while Greer heals up. "We've built great depth at running back, guys that I'm really proud of," Gersh said. "Obviously, Nate Omabu is Nate. He brings a lot of experience and a lot to that position, and he's a guy who can carry the load, but he won't have to. We've got some other guys that we feel good about." Kaysen Phillips stepped in on Saturday and had some really big runs for us, including a 46-yard touchdown run. Braden Wilcox is a redshirt freshman from Cristoval who's done a lot for us. He's so athletic and he brings a lot of versatility to this game. And Tyler Cleveland is a young man who has been in the program for a while. "Between those four guys, I feel like our production can maintain what it's been and keep working hard until Alfred's ready to go again." And now here is the weekly column from Allison Watkins. "Recent rainfall brings resurgence of insect pests in Concho Valley," published September 15th. "The recent rainfall was very welcome. Though it wasn't enough to take us out of drought conditions, it was a big boost for struggling plants. Unfortunately, it also helped weeds and insect pests come back strong. There have been many questions coming into the extension office regarding aphids and the sticky honeydew they expel. The stickiness is especially prevalent around pecan trees, but can be from oak trees and others. Aphids don't generally cause enough damage to trees to require treatment, but the stickiness that gets on cars, sidewalks, etc., is enough for many homeowners to want to treat. Be careful to not overuse pesticides in the landscape, as aphid infestations are very likely to increase after pesticide application. This happens because of the damage to natural enemy populations. Beneficial predator insects, such as lady beetles and green lacewings, feed on aphids and help keep them under control. Consider products with the active ingredient acetamiprid or imidazoprid and ensure that the product is labeled for aphid control on bearing pecans if the nuts are to be harvested at the end of the season. Some examples include Bayer Advanced Fruit, Citrus, and Vegetable Insect Control and Ortho Fruit, Flower, and Vegetable Insect Killer. Though the honeydew can be a major annoyance, it may not be worth the expense and trouble of treating this late in the season. Apply the treatment next spring to prevent the problem through the growing season. Fall webworms may also be a worry for homeowners. Like aphids, they do not harm established trees, but they can reduce a pecan crop and can be unsightly in the landscape. Spinosad and BT are two biological organic pesticides that control caterpillars well, but they are more effective if the webs are torn open first. Simply use a long stick to pull at the webbing. This helps the spray penetrate into the webs and contact the caterpillars, and also allows birds to eat them. Army worms are caterpillars that feed on turf foliage, causing a striped appearance. They don't often kill healthy, well-established lawns, but can be a threat to newly planted or stressed lawns. Pyrethroid insecticides such as cyfluorithrin and cypermethrin can be used to control army worms. Always read and follow labels when applying any insecticide to the landscape. Join the Concho Valley Master Gardeners on Saturday, September 24th for a workshop on fall vegetable gardening in containers. Or stop by after the workshop to purchase some cool season vegetables such as Swiss chard, lettuce, and spinach. The workshop, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., requires pre-registration. Visit https://tomgreen.agrilife.org or call 325-659-6522. And we'll include a hands-on planting project that you take home with you. Or just stop by from 10 a.m. to noon or until sold out to purchase leafy green vegetables and herbs grown by the Master Gardeners. Location, Tom Green 4-H Center, 3168 North U.S. Highway 67. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.